So here we are at the main course. Hey, Katie.
Hi, Patrick.
You're Katie Kiefer, right?
And you're Patrick Martins.
That's true. So here we are on Mother's Day.
Happy Mother's Day to all you mothers out there.
And you're a mother, right?
I am a mother. And we have a mother in the studio today with us.
My mother. This studio has never been so clean.
It's true. She came in here like a dynamo.
I know. It was like a whirlwind.
It was.
Scary. She's actually going to be a guest later on the Q Report with Mark and Ed. But this is a pretty interesting show we pulled together.
We have a very interesting lineup today. We have people who are in the restaurant industry as foragers, as managers, as chefs, who are going to be talking about sourcing and how they decide what they're going to buy and who they're going to buy it from.
What I kind of like is we have, there's like parallels. From the West Coast, we have Kathy Wims, who runs Nostrana, which is an independently owned restaurant in Portland. We also have Paul Ehrenstam, who runs like an institutionalized dining extension in San Francisco, Hotel Vitale, which is part of the Joie de Vivre hospitality group. So it's kind of independent institution. And then here in New York, we have Sarah, who's with Frankie Spatino. And that's kind of like, I view it as more of an independent, you know.
Oh, most definitely.
Even though it's a...
And an entity that's looking to sort of push itself into a new form because they're opening a butcher shop soon enough.
Mm-hmm.
Working on it now.
We also have Kate Sanzine from who manages Balthazar, which is a kind of institution. I mean, there's millions of people going in and out of that place every day.
Absolutely.
Have you been to all of those restaurants?
Oh, well, I've certainly been to Balthazar many times. I've never been to Frankie's, I don't think, but I'll definitely have to put it on my list of places to go, not to be missed, particularly because of the upcoming opening of their meat solutions.
And one of the things I was kind of excited to talk about was RSAs, which are restaurant-supported agriculture.
Yeah.
You know, I kind of always viewed Heritage Foods, which is the company that I run, as an RSA anchor, you know, trying to help restaurants support community-supported agriculture through, you know, a kind of clearinghouse.
Absolutely.
But I know restaurants probably do that anyway, but, you know, I guess maybe chefs don't.
I don't think that many.
Yeah,
because... I actually don't think there are that many. In fact, I only know of one really organized entity in Cleveland that's run by a chef named Steve Schmoller. And he has a restaurant called Crop, and mm-hmm. he has organized a cooperative of farmers and then hooked them in with Sysco, the huge broadline distributor. And so Sysco, instead of driving around with empty trucks, is going around to these various farmers and picking up their produce and distributing it to restaurants that Steve has connected into this network. But I don't think that is something that is widely organized in New York's in the tri-state area even. I haven't heard of anybody else really
doing that. Because I guess maybe a lot of the smaller farmers want to sell retail. And don't want to have to settle for wholesale prices because there's a few enough of them and enough people willing to spend money that...
But then they have to go through farmers markets, don't they? So, I mean, isn't it for them more of a guarantee of sales to be connected to some kind of a distribution network where they're selling all of their product? I mean, I know that Baldor Distribution is connected, has started to support a whole group of farmers in the Catskills. And... they're buying all of their produce up and bringing it down and distributing it to restaurants and into the retail trades. But that's the only organization I know that's really supporting farmers the way we would like to see them supported.
No, absolutely. We should get those Baldor guys on. Do you know them?
Yes, I do.
All right. Well,
we'll make that happen next
time. We'll make that happen. No, because I've spoke at a few agricultural conferences in upstate New York, and everyone is mentioning Baldor and how awesome they've been, like over decades and decades, like
absolutely.
The anchor, then connecting them to the city. Because it seems like these New York State farmers are more removed from New York City than we are, for instance, from farmers in Nebraska or whatever. You know,
in many ways, I think that's true. Absolutely.
It's kind of sad.
Yeah.
Well, I guess we are about to go to break. And when we come back, we're going to have Paul Ehrenstam on.
From Joie de Vivre, from
Hotel Vitale. Yeah, he's been a great supporter of Heritage. And he actually just bought a half beef from us from a local California farm.
Fantastic.
Which is no small investment. And it's a lot of weight and a lot of specials.
It's a lot of work.
Yeah, especially in front of the house, like they only have two order specials of hanger, eight of ribeye, you know, and it forces the kitchen also to really think on their toes.
That's right.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So we're back here with the main course. And actually, our first guest is going to be Kathy Wims, who's one of my favorite chefs that I've ever met through all my years in the food world. Kathy, are you with us? Kathy?
Kathy? Well, we should remind the audience that this is Heritage Foods Radio, and this is Patrick Martins and Katie Kiefer, and we're talking about how people get the food they get and where they get it from and how they serve it up to their consumers and all things in distribution and sustainable agricultural practice.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's actually find out how long we can ask our producers, I guess. Is that allowed to talk to admit that they're producers?
I think everyone's... we can admit that there is a producer and good, that there's good, even good. An engineer.
Hey, guys, we have Anoop, Heather, and Nat out there doing a great job. So, no updates. 30 seconds. All right. Well, Kathy Wims is awesome. I met her through Peter DeGarmo, who is the chapter leader of Slow Food in Portland. And he actually opened a store called Pasta Works, which was in a really run-down part of Portland, Oregon. It was like Hawthorne Avenue, and no businesses opened there. And here he was opening Pasta Works, you know, this kind of fresh pasta-making shop, and everyone thought he was crazy. Of course, since then, in the past 20 years, it's turned into one of the really cool neighborhoods, and everyone loves it. And he started what was actually the very first convivium of slow food. People used to compete who had the oldest convivium of slow food, the oldest chapter, and mm-hmm. he beat everybody by like 5 years. I mean, he, as of 1990, was running a slow food convivium because of some event he had been to in Turin where Carlo spoke. So he introduced us to a lot of people, one of the best of which is Kathy. Hey, Kathy. Ooh, Kathy's still not on. So anyway, yeah.
What's Kathy's restaurant name again?
Well, she used to be with Genoa, which was, I guess, the Chez Panisse of Portland. You know, mm-hmm. it was very, very expensive. You know, super good sourcing. And she was like this energy in the kitchen. You know, she just had this fierce energy to source everything herself and, you know, do everything in a very hardcore manner. And I think she really came to fame through Genoa, and actually her assistant end up becoming Alice Waters' assistant, Sylvan Brackett. And
so now she's running Nostrani. Hi. Oh, there you are.
Hey, Kathy.
Yeah.
Can Hi, you Kathy hear us? Wims.
You're way far away.
Can you hear us at all?
Yeah, now I can. Now I can.
All right, cool. Well, thanks for being here. I know it's early over there.
Oh, it is a little early, but, you know, I'm waiting to go to the farmer's market. It opens at 10 o'clock at Hillsdale Shopping Center. So it's not that early.
And you're actually on with Katie Kiefer, who is co-host. There's a co-host here, Katie Kiefer.
Oh, hi, Katie.
Hi, Kathy. It's really nice to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
So what foods are you going to find when you go to the farmer's market in Portland?
What am I going to get at the farmer's market in Portland?
Yeah, I mean, what's available?
I'm hoping that there'll be some early new potatoes, which not many of the farmers have yet. And there's actually the first strawberries kind of showed up this weekend, and so we're going to hopefully have strawberries with balsamic vinegar on vanilla gelato for Mother's Day this evening.
Very nice.
Uh-huh.
And now the bounty of the Pacific Northwest, I mean, is one of the most fascinating in the country. I mean, I've always thought that was the coolest terroir kind of the region. I mean, are you able, of the country, are you able to source 100% locally? I mean, is it that bountiful up there?
It's not quite like California because, you know, we don't grow, it's not warm enough to grow any citrus. And so I never have figured that part of it out. And so, you know, I haven't figured out how to cook without lemon juice and stuff, but pretty much everything else, probably 96%, we are able to source locally.
So all your fish and all your protein comes locally?
Almost completely, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We have incredible ranchers that we get whole lamb from, and whole pigs. Laughing Stock Farm is incredible. Pork producer, it produces a Duroc cross that we get, and we get amazing lamb from Cattail Creek Farm, and Strawberry Mountain beef is from Eastern Oregon, and pretty much everything is local.
So is that your buying philosophy, just stay local, or is there a buying philosophy within the buy local kind of thing that you try to follow?
I guess there's both. The name of my restaurant is Nostrana, and in Italian that means ours, but in relationship to food, it actually means what is local, and it comes with a hidden meaning of that it's more valuable, more highly prized, and more delicious. But then within that, I think it's really important to support the key farmers and the key ranchers that we do deal with, because there's so many people, so many amazing organic farmers here in Oregon that I could
really... Oh, sounds like we just lost her. Ooh. Oh, what a shame. Ouch.
We just lost her.
Technology. Well, my next question for her, and we'll ask her when we get her back, is how the economics of that works in the context of running a restaurant, because it's so expensive to source like that, and how do you sort of balance that with not passing all those costs on to the consumer, or how do you sell the consumer on paying those higher prices? I think that's sort of the burning issue for anybody who's in the restaurant industry, is how you make that sale, because it is hard.
How do you make it do? Yeah, and I wonder, the food cost, what is the proportion? Like, if you buy something, like if it's the center of the cut, center of the plate is like $3, you have to charge $9 for it.
Right.
I mean, we had Renato Sardo on, and he was like, the dirty truth is consumers just have to pay more.
Yeah.
Eat a little less, $2 more, $3 more, I mean, it doesn't seem like the end of the world. I think sometimes we build our arguments around a very small socioeconomic group, and we're not necessarily aware that you can still charge more for food, and it's okay, even though we need... It's not a be-all and end-all solution. You know what I mean? It seems like, chefs
are... Well, I think consumers have to get used to the idea that the era of really cheap commodity food is coming to an end. And, with all of the sort of information that's coming out to the consumer now about practices in the commodity protein industry, and indeed in all agricultural aspects in growing grains and so forth, there is a huge price extracted from the land and the environment, which has to be paid for. Oh, you back, Kathy?
Yeah, I'm back.
Yay.
So ask your question, Katie.
So my question was...
Now I'm gone.
No, you're not. You're still there.
Okay, good.
Okay. The question we had for you was the economics of this. Like, it costs...
I can't hear you.
The economics of sourcing locally the way you do and supporting organic farmers and local, protein producers and so on. How do you balance that in terms of passing those costs on to the consumer without kind of driving them away, especially nowadays?
I think what you're asking me, and I'm sorry, but your voice keeps cutting off.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Is how do I source locally and sustainably and still keep the price affordable to the customer?
That's what I'm asking.
That's like the biggest challenge.
It
of
is,
all.
Right?
It's gigantic, because it's really, even in, I think, a very food savvy town like Portland, Oregon, where most people are, well, most people is a strong thing, but many, 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 many people shop at farmers markets, see the price of things that farmers are charging, is turning that around in a restaurant and, charging the markup you need to charge to pay for your rent and your staff and all your fixed cost is really, really walking a fine line.
Definitely.
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, I try and, actually I'm very excited by a concept called, it's Italian type of cooking called La Cucina Povera, which is really cooking with inexpensive ingredients like beans and grains and...
And using just a little bit of meat to season a whole pot of something.
Yeah, and I think that actually, it's considered, it's a very healthy way of eating, and so I think that's attractive to... customers, and it allows, and I don't have to charge as much for it, even though I might be buying the very, very best heirloom beans by a local farmer that sourced the seed from Italy and dried the beans for us, or this is Ayers Creek Farm in Gaston, Oregon, and he also grows heirloom varieties of corn, dries it, and grinds it to order for our polenta. So I can have like an A1, incredible ingredient, but of an ingredient that's not like an expensive protein that I can just enrich with some really nice, like,
I think that's the direction that food should really start going in. I'm actually teaching a course in Cucina Provera with a friend of mine who is a Southern Italian cook named Erica Demain, and we're doing a course called Recession Cooking for that very reason. And the idea is to use cheap ingredients and very little protein and make something really fantastic.
The Chicago Tribune, their cover story was about lesser cuts of the animals, chicken legs, tri-tip, you know, on the beef.
Well, the whole, I mean, the protein industry, the beef industry especially, is really going in for taking the quote-unquote pressure off the middle meats. And I think, do you buy whole animals or large primal cuts yourself for the restaurant?
We do for, with pigs and lamb because they're kind of smaller. My restaurant has 90 seats, but I haven't figured out how to, like, deal with a whole side of beef. That's just a little too big for us. And also it requires, I think, more... like serious butchering equipment than I actually have, but we do regularly buy whole pigs and whole lamb.
And do you try to use a lot of ground or hams and things like that? I mean, are farmers
a lot of ground
meat, for instance, or local cow farms always asking you to buy like a case of ground just to help them offset, you know, relieve the middle meats, as Katie said.
We do actually. We do with a beef producer, which is Highland Oaks Beef, which is grass fed beef. So. In that case, we're actually using his sort of lesser cuts to help him out because he doesn't have any problem. He also sells at the local farmers markets, you know, selling off his, you know, his rib steaks, his New York steaks, and, you know, all the things that, that people easily want to buy and don't have to think too hard about how to cook it.
That's
so
right.
I'm able to help him out by buying the ground meat, the lesser cuts, and incorporating that into dishes.
What kinds of lesser cuts? Because I know, for instance, in New York, there's a butcher who's buying whole in Brooklyn, actually, who's buying whole animals, and they're trying to educate consumers in how to use things like the tri-tip or some of the, you know, the from the plate, which is the belly of the animal, or even the National Cattlemen's Beef Association has been trying to educate chefs on which parts of the chuck roll can be turned into something more palatable to the consumer. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's definitely a challenge, but it's also an imperative, I think, is if we want to continue to see the cattle industry, you know, thrive here, we have to get people
be
to
dynamic,
use other
yeah.
pieces.
Kathy, by the way, congratulations on your James Beard nomination. I thought
that was pretty cool.
I wanted to ask, we only have like a minute left, and you've been great to be on so early. There's so much good stuff going on in Portland. Like, could you just speak a little bit to the city itself and how there's just like an amazing array of restaurants?
There was a fantastic article this morning that I haven't even finished yet, but I'm almost through, about Frugal Portland in the New York Times, and a great story about the food cart phenomenon that's happening in Portland. Also the microbreweries and small spirit distillers like House Spirits and the Pioneer Clear Creek Distillery. Cocktails are just like booming in Portland. Clyde Common and a new opening bar called Beaker and Glass is opening.
That's a takeoff. That's our takeoff sound effect we did for that, Kathy.
Okay.
Well, no, I mean, takeoff, like it's taking off. It's being successful. No, I mean, food carts are great here. I mean, the Roberta's guys where we're broadcasting from are opening a gelato cart in June, you know, and it's definitely Portland. A lot of trends seem to start in Portland.
My favorite coffee in all of Portland is Stella Cafe, and it's just a food cart downtown, but you can have a real Italian coffee, and whenever I have a visiting Italian friend, I always take them straight there, and they're happy. They feel like they're at home.
That's fantastic.
Awesome. Well, Kathy, thanks so much. I hope next time you're in the city, you can come to the studio itself. But thanks so much for being on.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Studio. Bye.
Bye-bye, Kathy. Take care.
Thank you.
We're back to the main course, Patrick Martins.
And Katie Kiefer.
And our second guest, Kathy, was a great guest. And now we have Paul Ehrenstam. Hey, Paul, are you with us?
I am. Good morning.
How's it going?
Or, I guess good afternoon for you guys.
It's early for you, too.
Sure.
Well, thanks for being on. So tell us about a little bit about Hotel Vitale and where you're from, just to give people where you work and what you do in San Francisco, just to give people an idea.
Sure. Hotel Vitale is a 200-room boutique hotel located on the Embarcadero waterfront in San Francisco. We opened in 2005, and the hotel's Restaurant Americano is the restaurant, and I've been there since we've opened.
And now it's part of the Joie de Vivre dining group, right? I mean, is that...
Yeah, they're a small boutique hotel company with properties located up and down California.
And how is it sourcing? I know how committed you are to sustainability, Paul. I mean, how has it been for you, you know, working within, you know, how is it different, for instance, in a hotel or needing to feed hundreds and hundreds of people, especially where you guys are located, right, overlooking the Ferry Plaza, Farmers Market? I mean, how do you pull it off?
Well, I think, you know, our location, we're located right across the street from the Ferry Building and the Farmers Market, so... the location helps. It makes it a little bit easier. I think that in San Francisco, it's kind of the norm. So being located in a hotel isn't the most unique thing for us as far as getting our for people to realize that we have that connection to the farmers market. But it's something that I've been doing and have been here for a number of years. And so it just felt like a natural extension of what I would normally do for any restaurant that I was the chef of.
Paul, do you find that that being part of a big hospitality group like Joie de Vivre has imposed any kind of restrictions on your ability to buy or source? Like, do they, because I'm sure they give you a budget, or is your restaurant just kind of a freestanding entity where you can pretty much call your own shots? Because I know it's hard to work within a group like that.
I think I would say there are two answers to that question, and a lot of it is, Initially, the freedom I was given or have been given was pretty extensive, and it still extends to the farmers market and working with the local farmers. As the company has grown and as our economy has sort of shifted a little bit, there are now some more opportunities, I guess you will, for leveraged buying, which is a different kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I work within the parameters and the framework that they give me. And I try to make the best choices I can because I do control most of the purchasing and spending within the restaurant and the hotel.
Are you able to contract with farmers for like their entire crop of something, or can you make deals in advance with farmers in that respect, or are you pretty much dependent on what's happening in the market?
Yeah, I kind of use the market more as a guide. I don't have any. I guess in some small ways I do. I mean, I work with Hearst Ranch down. And on the Central Coast, but you know, we look to whatever farmers are at the Ferry Building, and use them in whatever seasonal way that we can.
And how complicated is it to buy from so many different people? I mean, do you just deal with cash, or do you have accounts with hundreds of people? Are they calling you to tell you what they're going to bring in, or do you change the menu daily? You know, even for all that all those people that come in each night.
Well, I mean, we have a number of different farms that we work with on market day. It's primarily cash. Some, if we call in advance, can provide an invoice and we're on billing terms, which helps a great deal. and then we have a sort of a mainline supplier for everyday things that, you know, a kitchen would use, staples. So for us, it's just a matter of kind of keeping up with what's happening at the market currently and making adjustments with our system in terms of when cash is needed. You know, I have a petty cash bank, just like I would be if I was a front-of-the-house manager of a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. To go back just for a second with what you just said about how you source your staples, obviously you have to work with broadline distributors. I imagine you use Sysco or U.S. Foods or somebody like that. How sympathetic do you find those broadliners to the whole issue
well,
of sustainable...
Well, you know, I think... Sorry, I lost you there for a second.
I'm just wondering how sympathetic the broadliners are in terms of working regionally or sourcing regionally for some of those staples like onions or carrots. I mean, you're in California, so they grow that stuff there.
Right. Well, we don't use, in terms of the broadliners, I don't use anything that would be produce-based from them. Any of sort of the grocery items that you would find in the hotel.
So it's all dry goods and
the food.
Mm-hmm. It's all dry goods from them?
Right, right. So, you know, we have some staples that a hotel would need. You know, we do a room service, a breakfast, a lunch, and dinner. Mm-hmm. So we try to provide things that are typical in a luxury hotel. With that, though, we you know, the produce, we don't have to use those broadliners in that way.
That's good.
At least not yet. So we'll see what happens in the future.
Right. Well, wouldn't you like to see broadliners pick up more of that kind of regional distribution? Wouldn't that be like a desirable outcome?
Sure. I think it would absolutely make sense. And I think when the evidence that these could be good for business, not only are they good decisions, but they're also good business decisions as well. Mm-hmm. So I hope that does become something that is a standard.
And I want to ask, in New York, there's always like a limited amount of great produce. And so there's like competition amongst the chefs for who's going to get there earlier, or who's going to develop a secret relationship with a certain farmer. Is there such an abundance out there that that doesn't really exist? Or do some people get things that others don't?
Well, I mean, yes, is a good example. I had Lucero Farms, who has some of the best strawberries that are out here, probably 60 miles west of San Francisco. They come in every Saturday to the farmer's market. Obviously, the Mother's Day weekend strawberries were very popular. I had called ahead for four flats. I got there, I thought it was fairly, you know, mid-morning. It's about 10:30, and they had been sold out. They were just waiting for me to pick them up, so... I usually don't see those kind of things because most of the restaurants will call ahead and have something reserved. But, you know, I don't think it seems to be quite as bad as there in New York. We do have a much longer growing season, and that particular market, the San Francisco market, is so well attended.
Well, awesome, Paul. I mean, it's nice to get you on early on in the life of the Heritage Radio Network. I know you're a great supporter of a number of great things, and so I look forward to following your career through the network over the following years.
Yeah, well, we're excited, too. We've always been proud that we're a part of Heritage Foods, and you guys are doing a great job. So thanks for having me on.
Thanks very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Paul.
Sure. Happy Mother's Day. At least I got laid.
Changing my employment to increase my enjoyment. It could have been a whole lot harder if my decision weren't already made. They were always talking loud, but they were never saying nothing. Talking about creation and commitment and being and becoming. Payday came and went, and the cash wasn't there. And when they offered me a minimum wage, well, I fled from that cage. Changing my employment to increase my enjoyment.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by our friends at TechServe. www.techserve.com. Today's program was brought to you by...
All right. So that was exciting. I mean, two West Coast people. I feel bad. I feel like I woke up two people.
I think they were up. If you're in the restaurant industry, you're up early.
No, really? I think you're up late and then up
late. Not when
late.
It's Mother's Day.
All right. You're right. It's Mother's Day.
It's a busy day for a restaurant owner or a chef.
So did you get a call or flowers or anything from your kids?
Actually, my daughter was embarrassed that she had forgotten. But since I'm not a big fan of Mother's Day, I feel like every day is Mother's Day.
You don't want to support Hallmark?
No, I don't. Aww. Call me crazy.
Think about all those poor people that like design all those things.
Well, my daughter is very appreciative all days, so she doesn't need to expect make a special day for me.
Yeah, rites of passage are blown up too much anyway. So, all right, we have Sarah Barber on from Frankie's Patino. Hey, Sarah.
Hi.
How's it going?
It's going well, thank you.
Where are you coming from today? Were you coming from Frankie's? Did you work or
when? No, today I'm not at work today, but I was there. I was at the market yesterday, and then I'm generally there Monday through Friday and Saturday mornings.
Tell us what you do exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I've been brought on to work with Frankie Spuntino and their new restaurant, Prime Meats, to help focus on the food buying. We do have our executive chef and a few other chefs, and actually having someone to help them in the food sourcing, I think, helps out a lot because everyone is really busy. And so it's a fun job. It's kind of a unique position in the restaurant industry, I think.
I'm totally jealous. That's yeah, what I want to do.
You're like a lone wolf in the industry. So foraging is a very, very new word. I mean, like, it seemed like 10 years ago no one even knew what that word was, and now here you are, you know, foraging for a Brooklyn restaurant. I mean, what are some of the things that you've had to do at the beginning? Like, is it proteins, is it vegetables?
It's setting up kind of a basic procurement system as well, just sort of setting up a system that we can all work with and make sure that, you know, there's food to sell in there every day, and lining up some people that make it easy and do it well. Which in New York, I'm from the West Coast as well, but it's amazing the type of products you have out here and the different types of organizations that are, you know, mainlining straight into the city. So Baldor, I think, is one of them too. But there's also several other kind of off the top of my head that. That have been really fun to work with as well. Yeah.
And, I mean, where do you come, how did you come to foraging? I mean, did you study in California also, UC Davis? Is that
I
right?
I did a master's program at UC Davis in international agricultural development. So I kind of have a love of the production system of food growing, and my focus there was, genetic diversity of food crops, which is what you do. In the livestock world. Absolutely. So I did that in the crop world a little bit. And
what were some of the cool things? Like, who were your professors? Like, what was your paper on or some
so
of
So my
your...
professor was Paul Gepps, who was a bean geneticist, excuse me. And I got to do my thesis work down in Mexico. So I got to stay there for 6 months and work with some traditional farmers down there that cultivate the traditional milpa system, which was really lovely.
What is that?
The traditional bean, corn, and squash mixture that is grown for home consumption mainly.
What? Yeah. They make a porridge out of that?
No, it's just a row cropping
system.
Oh, you
mean
system. Those Sorry.
Three,
yeah.
Oh, it's a yeah, rotation
so they're all,
system.
So you have your maize stalks and the beans grow up and then the squash grows in between. It's kind of the prehistoric, pre-Columbian traditional agricultural
cool.
system. Yeah.
And now you graduated from your master's in what year?
I was done there in about 2006.
Okay, so then this came soon right after.
Yeah, I came out to New York to work with a friend. I've been in the produce industry. We kind of imported the fresh herb line and distributed it. And then it's been kind of back and forth to California, and I came on with the Franks to kind of start this project. So, yeah.
Very nice. And what are some of the things, surprises? I mean, living on the West Coast, coming to the East Coast. I mean, are farmers receptive? Is creating a system an easy thing in a Brooklyn restaurant that's been around for a bit?
Well, you have such a high volume of people here, I feel like. And one of the things, too, that I feel like exists here, and I'm just starting to get to know it, but there's certain buyers that will kind of monopolize the supply. So you kind of have to seek out farther and kind of get your own supply coming into your restaurant.
Has it been hard for you to develop a network of your own? Like, because I imagine you have to create relationships with specific people in order to get what you want and to get the prices you want. Are you able to negotiate prices at all, or does it depend on how much volume you're moving? Or
I guess with the pricing, it's hard. You know, you don't want to lowball down to the, you know, you want to support your farmer too. You want to support your producer. And I'm not sure how much of a markup they're making anyhow. Mm-hmm. So I kind of, so far, like to just deal within the prices that are given. Mm-hmm. And if we're able to pull more volume, and then you kind of have more leverage for price negotiation, depending on kind of how good of a customer you are.
And how do you get to know the, because you're working directly with farmers, I assume, at least for some
farmers and organizations that kind of organize a group of farmers. Like, we're working with one called Lancaster Farm Fresh, who organizes about 50 Amish farmers out in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And they do an amazing job at what they do with beautiful, beautiful produce delivered, really organized. So they've been really great to work with. One of my favorites.
I would imagine.
The Amish. I was friends with some Amish people, Reverend Schlabach. The head Amish person of his community in Berlin, Ohio. And actually his family was driven. They're allowed to be driven, but they can't drive. Driving to visit some Mennonites, I guess, in northern New York. And they stopped by Manhattan in a van, like 15 of them. I took them to the Empire State Building. And, they did it as a kind of like recognizance mission, I guess. And they trusted I was there. But when I got that call from their driver, like, we're on Franklin Delano Roosevelt Drive, driving south. I'm like, get in your right lane. I was like so protective of these guys. But it was funny, and all the storefront owners came out. I mean, that's a great untapped resource, the Amish. Although I also hear negative things about, like, there's some dog, puppy hospital. What do they call them? Like, they breed. I don't know. Have you heard anything?
No, I haven't.
Anyway, yeah, my friend, I have huge respect for the Amish, and, it would be nice if there was more of a connection to the city. With their products. Well, we are going to come back with Sarah again, and I want to kind of ask, like, your personal philosophy, like, where you hope to see your system grow in the next years. So here we are back at the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Giefer, and we're here with Sarah Barber today. She's the forager for Frankie Spatino.
And let's see if we have any call-ins. Oh, wait, that's not good. That's no, just kidding. Our call-in thing does not work. That was actually a thing for that. No, but we've yet to receive that many call-ins. But I wanted to ask you, like, this program that you're implementing at Frankie's Spatino, which is on LeCur Street in Cobble Hill, is that right?
It's on Court Street, between 4th Place and LeCur.
LeCur, right.
Is the proper way to pronounce
Sorry.
It.
Sorry. Yeah. God, wait a second. I hope you say Houston, because it's, or Houston, because it's Houston. What is your, let's say, 5-year plan with this system that you have in place, or a 3-year plan or a 1-year plan? I mean, how do you kind of envision it playing out in the future?
Well, in the New York area, you have your growing season that is much shorter than the West Coast, obviously. And, but really supporting some of the local produce and agriculture, during the growing season, it's coming on, a little bit before now, all through, I guess, through October. And then, in the wintertime, you have to have your other supply, your kind of more commodity agriculture going on. And so the produce part, I feel like, is fairly simple to bring in fresh to the restaurant. And then the other part of it is your meat and your dairy, which is so abundant up here. And as we move in with our meat program, I think that will be our biggest focus of concentration and maybe the most complicated part of it, mm-hmm. making the economics of the meat work. I think you guys were talking about that earlier. Yeah,
I mean, with the cow, essentially, we're trying to sell half animals because, out of a, 180-pound half, half of an animal, when you cut it into its pieces, like 80 pounds of that is ground meat. So, you know, where the ground goes is where the cow farmer goes, which is why I always tell farmers in upstate New York, don't raise cows, do goats or sheep or, you know, some kind of smaller animal. But have you made inroads? I mean, there's a lack of slaughterhouses upstate. I mean, there's not much local protein coming into New York. How have you found navigating it early on?
There's one cooperative called Hardwick Beef Cooperative that does grass-fed, grass-finished.
Out of Massachusetts?
It's a cooperative, so they're in upstate, they're in Pennsylvania, so I think they kind of span that region a little bit, and they go through their own, through Angelo's distribution. So that's one of the ways that they distribute, and their slaughterhouse is in Troy, Pennsylvania. Mike Labak, who I think was just mentioned, just read about him a couple weeks ago, and they seem to do a really good job at what they do. So they're someone that I'm familiar with. And then there's some other cattle producers that I've spoken with, but they do the whole animal more. So it's difficult to do the primal cuts if that's what you want, because you're looking at $2.39 a pound versus $6.49 a pound for your already cut grass-fed portion, and so the economics of that are more difficult.
What's hard to balance? Because on the one hand, you have to use, if you buy a whole half of a cow, you also have to allocate a lot of resources in your kitchen to butchering it and to managing the parts that are not of the obvious things to sell, like the steaks or the chops or whatever they are. So you have to figure out how to either cure the meats or make sausages or grind the beef and make that into dishes. So that would be, to me, that's the most interesting part of the economic puzzle, is how you can rectify that disparity between the prices by, you know, are you paying more in labor costs or are you paying more for the more finished product? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely an investment in your labor and in your chef to come in with the knowledge and the skill set to deal with the whole animal. And I know that we have three, four amazingly talented chefs that once we have the equipment and the attention and the focus, that they'll be able to do that once. But it does take a full commitment from the entire restaurant to make that happen.
Absolutely. Even the architects of the Prime Meats kitchen is kind of built in a way to deal with the whole animal.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So it was definitely built with that in mind, but I think it's several months off. It takes, you know, to gear into that and to be able to deal with it, but I think it'll be great when it happens.
And it's part of a bigger expansion for Frankie's in general, right? I mean, there's going to be a bar, also kind of like a bar in front of Prime Meats, is that right?
They're going to have a kind of a general store, a little store there with the butcher, and sort of this real, Frankie's has always been kind of a neighborhood restaurant, and I think with Prime Meats, they're expanding that neighborhood sort of philosophy. So you can come around the corner and you can pick up meat, you can pick up some other nice things and food to go, and I think it'll be great. Those guys, they have great ideas.
So they're going to do a prepared food section along with
I think they might have a little bit of that. It's still in the works, but it will, I think the main idea is for it to be a place where, you know, you can come down the street and pick up something to eat, whether cook it yourself or have it prepared already.
We did that in Manhattan. I worked in a butcher shop called Broadway Butcher, and I ran the prepared foods. And then we had a butcher shop, like, you know, just a standard butcher shop. And so you could buy a steak or a chop, and then you bought ratatouille or scalloped potatoes or some other thing from me, and that was the whole meal. You didn't have to shop anywhere else. And we had bread and we had pate and eggs. It was great.
Yeah.
And that doesn't really exist anymore, so it's really nice to hear that Prime Meats is going to be picking up that baton and carrying it on forward.
We kind of have our Brooklyn shift over here of the shift of
I know, cool.
Of the way absolutely. We think about food, so it's an exciting place to be.
I think. Butchers, what a great trade to revive, you know, the butcher that knows the cuts and that's part of the community and that's there day in and day out working with the farmers. I mean, it's ideal. Well, actually, one of the things you guys buy is Balthazar breads, right?
We do. We have dealt with Balthazar, and they're an amazing bakery. And
thanks, Heather. God. No, well, it is very cool. basically, the reason I brought that up is because Kate's here. She's going to be our next guest. We'd love for you to stay on. And she's from Balthazar, which, of course, has managed to industrialize, in a way, a very good process without losing any quality. And I know a lot of people buy bread from them. So anyway, well, Sarah, thanks so much for coming on. And
thank you so much. It's been fun.
Good.
Sorry. I wouldn't want our other bake.
Here we are at the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
I'm Katie Kiefer.
And we have a new guest, Kate Sanzine.
Oh, very nice. Kate Sanzine is a manager at Balthazar's, which is one of the more popular restaurants in Manhattan. Kate, nice to have you on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So tell us, Kate, a little bit about Balthazar's. Like, what would you say Balthazar's buying philosophy is? Or just philosophy in general of, you know, giving something to the buying public.
We want to make the most money possible. Just kidding.
Yikes.
No, sorry.
Stopped us in our tracks.
Sounds very draconian.
I'm not the purchasing department, but you know, we have a kind of a responsibility to be accessible to lots of different kinds of people. We have people coming, you know, who don't get out to restaurants very often. We have people who are coming from the middle of the country to a special place that they've heard of. We have people from around the block, around the corner. We have kind of high profile people coming in. So Keith, the owner, really wants us to be accessible to kind of a wide range of people. And so we have to keep things not too expensive. You can go into Balthazar and have a casual lunch for $40 or $30, or you could drop $1,000 if you wanted. So I know you guys were talking about money before and price point, and it's such an issue in restaurants. I mean, everywhere, I guess, but it's so expensive to run a restaurant, and there's so many different components to running it and so many things to distract you from kind of doing the right thing, that you have to get everyone on board. It's like the whole big ship. Everyone on the ship has to be wanting to go to the same place.
And that's almost a daily day in and day out to get people on board and focused on the right things, right? I mean, yeah. How many people work there, for instance, on a Saturday? Or in general?
Well, in general, we have about 300 people working at Balthazar.
Wow, and rallying that ship must be very, very difficult. What is your strategy for mobilizing your troops over there?
Well, I work in the front of the house, and you get swept up in the energy. You get swept up in the it's a controlled chaos. We want people to have a good time. We want them to kind of step out of their regular life. Americans, I'm counting myself among us, have a problem sometimes accepting that foraging for quality is something that they're worth doing. That kind of egalitarian, like, well, you know, your glass, you got half a glass, I should get half a glass too. So, you know what, dilute it. As long as I'm getting half a glass, you know, that's okay. And say the French or the Italians, French in particular, are very good at even legislating quality. And we Americans might think of them as snobs sometimes, but that notion of snobbery isn't necessarily a negative for them. And
it does have some good things, like our USDA is all safety oriented. Their equivalent of their safety group is all quality based, you know, which implies safety with it. But yeah, there is a certain lack of.
Also, I don't think I would call it, Americans interpret it as snobbery, but I think the French interpret that requirement of quality as kind of their right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have
pursuit of happiness.
Absolutely. It's part of what they expect from their lifestyle. And if it's not forthcoming, then they want to know why. Mm-hmm. Whereas Americans are content with something so far below even the most basic, you know, sort of elements of comfort and well-being, especially around food. I've always been amazed at how Americans are willing to settle for the lowest common denominator in food. And I guess that's what the difference is between our two nations, is that the French do not settle for the lowest common denominator. They demand a much higher standard. And
I actually just read this article. It was by Jerry Hirsch in the Los Angeles Times, that 18 volunteers were fed 5 food samples in a blind taste test, and only 3 were able to identify one of the secret testing things, which was dog food.
Oh.
So 3 out of 18 could distinguish the dog food. And I don't know if this really ties in, but it just says maybe we're so used to so little quality that we can't even distinguish dog food from pate, which was one of the other, foie gras was another one.
Oh my God.
So things have gotten pretty bad.
But when you eat regularly, I took a road trip recently down to DC, and we had to obviously make rest stops and so on. And the only food available is fast food. And each place was really more horrible than the last. It was, you really got a sampling of the big chains that dominate the food industry in this country. Fast food is the dominant industry, right? Thank you, Patrick.
That's it. No problem, Katie. I always got your back with the sound effects. But do you run into problems like that? Do Americans have trouble with Balthazar in a way? Do people get it?
I see what you're saying. We get them just as they come in the door. Sometimes it's overwhelming for them. I don't mean to say, oh, we're so great, but walking into the restaurant, it's a really beautiful place. You open the doors and you walk in, and it's transporting. And some people are really intimidated by that. Not that they're not sophisticated or not used to going places, but it's transporting. And particularly if you're visiting the city from somewhere else, it can be flooring. But you have to disarm them. Also, people expect us sometimes to be standoffish or nasty. So we have to try and be nice and help them through things. A lot of people aren't, comfortable looking at oysters and things like that in particular.
Although I say, stuff. You guys have the best back of the, the runners, the guys that do the water and stuff. I say the wait
bussers,
staff.
Bussers.
They're everywhere and nowhere, ooh, which is the best
that's
compliment.
That's what you want to hear, right,
Kate? Daniel Boulud said that about us once, too.
Really? Yeah, everywhere and nowhere? Nice, that bastard. I
that
can't
really
be telling him all my great ideas.
With the management of the bussers. It's really the management.
He learned how to cook from me, too, and he's made a lot of friggin' money off that. Anyway, so, well, Kate, I hope you're on many times. Sarah, I hope you're on many times. This has really been great. Very interesting. Almost like the people, the ladies that make Frankie's and Balthazar run.
That's right.
You know, it's
next time we're going to talk to you more about your sourcing.
Yeah, next time. Although, no, I
there'll
do say...
There'll be a quiz, Kate.
Balthazar sources from Heritage. I love it. They buy, you know, right. 200 pounds of center-cut loins a week, which is pretty amazing. They could certainly be spending a lot less.
Bless them.
Anyway, hopefully that'll explode. And anyway, this has been a great show so far. We're going to come back for one quick conclusion. All right.
Thanks, ladies.
Well, I grew up in the city. Land. And I used to have it space to roam, but most folks don't understand. Most folks don't understand.
I know we have two guests in house, so we're in our final segment. But before we say goodbye, we want to promote this amazing group, Trees Not Trash, and we have Corey Mason and Kate Gilliam with us.
Hi.
Hi, Patrick.
Tell us about Trees Not Trash.
Trees Not Trash. We started it in 2004. It's based in Bushwick. And it started off very much as a guerrilla gardening situation. We sort of reclaim unused land, turn it into community gardens, get street trees planted, and generally try and clean up the neighborhood.
Work with a lot of community kids.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And you just did one. We actually bumped into each other right around the corner
That's
from
right.
Roberta's, which is a beautiful bench, too, which is awesome for that street. More people that sit, the better it is.
Yeah. I was just sitting on it myself.
Yes.
And was it comfortable?
And enjoying it.
It didn't fall apart.
Good.
Not at all.
The other ones that were there were falling apart. It's part of a contest that we entered called Love Your Block, or Love Your New York City Block. It's sort of co-sponsored by Bloomberg and Citizens Committee for New York City.
Okay.
So we got a nominal grant to do Bogart Street.
Fantastic. Very, very nice.
Really
what a great street to do. Yeah, well, wherever there's people, there's safety and there's happiness and there's good energy.
That's
you know,
right.
If it's abandoned lot, you know, it's not so great. What are some of the next projects that you guys are working on?
We're working
besides
with...
Besides having a baby.
Yeah, which was supposed to happen yesterday, but...
But you
they
just
never
couldn't
come on
miss
time.
Your radio spot.
That's right. That was so important, my debut. We're doing a project with the Bushwick Public Library next, which is just down very close to Roberta's. And one of the public librarians there is interested in doing a community garden for the patrons, mostly the young patrons.
Sure.
But it's very visible, which is good. There's a housing project that backs right onto it, which is devoid of any green or trees or anything. So the more people can actually see what we're doing, the more they're encouraged to get involved.
This whole neighborhood is devoid of trees.
I mean, it is,
coming from the Upper West Side of Manhattan.
Yeah.
As much as it used to be, actually.
That's right.
Thanks to you guys,
thanks
obviously.
To Kate. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we've had about 100 trees planted to date.
That's fabulous.
And hope for
where do you source the trees
more.
From?
We steal them.
Nice.
No, just kidding.
I was going to say, Bloomberg is like...
No, we get some from Bloomberg.
Have you noticed less trees on the Upper West Side lately? They're here now. No, we we're lucky to have the Parks Department as good friends.
It's important.
The head of forestry and horticulture is now a good friend of mine.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So they donate trees to us. There's a local nursery in Williamsburg called the Sprout Home. They donate shrubs and trees, and also the Million Trees NYC. We have gotten some trees from them too.
Tell us how people can sign up for more information or send you guys an email and sign up to volunteer.
We have a website. It's treesnottrash.org. And the website you can email us through. It's getinvolved@treesnottrash. We garden every Sunday, usually from 1 till 4. In the summertime, we're out most days, though, after sort of work hours as well, around 6.
At Bogart and McKibben.
Oh, yes.
Bogart and McKibben, and you can also learn about this on the Heritage Foods Archive, and you'll be able to link directly to their site from there. So look onto the main course website, and this has been a pretty good show. I mean, really we had some fun. Technical difficulties, but I thought we did well. That was the first time we had been thrown into a improv.
Free fall. Yes,
I like your sound effect.
But we did a good job.
Can you do any more?
Well, you are a cougar for coming in.
Oh, yeah. Awesome.
And then hopefully, once you guys have the baby, you can get away for a little time on the beach.
Oh, no.
There you go. You got to. You have to come back for more.
We'll come back for more.
Please give us an update on your next project.
Yeah, stop in anytime.
That's terrific.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you guys.
For coming on.
And thanks, Katie.
Thanks, Patrick.
I'll see you next week. Are you coming next week?
You betcha.
Awesome.
Okay, babe. Bye-bye.
Let the sky